Good morning, everyone. This is the Registrar Roundtable on implementing recent transfer policy changes. Okay. And a special good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone who is joining us remotely from all hours. So the goal of today's session is for me to just quickly go over some of the definitions and the transfer policy process, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. We have a couple of members of both the working group and the implementation review team in the room. Theo Gertz from the implementation review team has generously volunteered to discuss some of the background information and implementation plans for his registrar that might prove to be helpful to other registrars in the room. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and get started on the transfer policy changes details. We went over these definitions on Tuesday, so I'll just quickly go through them. But the definition of a change of registrant is a material change to any of the following: the prior registrant name, prior registrant organization, prior registrant email address, or the administrative contact email address if there is no prior registrant email address, which just means that the registered nameholder email address field is blank. A material change is defined as a non-typographical change to any of those fields. The prior registrant is the registered nameholder when the change of registrant request is initiated, and the new registrant is the entity or person to whom that prior registrant is attempting to transfer the name to. So by way of example, if I were updating the WHOIS information from Caitlin Tubergen to Mukesh Chulani, in that example, I would be the prior registrant and Mukesh would be the new registrant. This slide shows some examples of material changes. I just wanted to include this for reference. These examples can be, I'm sorry, some examples of material changes can be found in the implementation notes to the policy. The next couple of slides detail what you can find in section C of the policy, and these are the steps found in the change of registrant. So the first step when someone attempts to update their name, organization, or email address is for the registrar to confirm that the name is eligible for a change of registrant. There are a couple of situations that are enumerated in the policy that explain when a name is ineligible for a change of registrant. So those situations include there's a current UDRP dispute, there's a court order, etc. The next step is for the registrar to confirm via a secure mechanism that the new registrant has explicitly consented to the change of registrant. And we'll talk a little bit later about what a secure mechanism is. After the registrar confirms that the new registrant explicitly consented to the change, the registrar needs to inform the prior registrant that if its final goal is to change the registrar and the registrant simultaneously, it is advised to request the inter-registrar transfer first. And that is because of the 60-day lock that follows the change of registrant. The next step would be to confirm via a secure mechanism that the prior registrant has explicitly consented to the change of registrant. After the registrar has received explicit consent from both the prior and new registrant, the registrar needs to process the change of registrant within 1 day of obtaining those confirmations. At that point, the registrar needs to send a notification to both the prior registrant and new registrant. And section C 1.1.6.1 through 1.1.6.6 details the requirements that need to be contained within that notification. Then the registrar needs to advise the prior registrant and new registrant of the 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock. And that is a lock that follows a change of registrant. And then the registrar would impose that 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock following the change of registrant. The 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock is opt-outable. So the registrar can allow the registrant to opt out of that 60-day lock prior to the change of registrant request. In the implementation notes to the policy, you'll see that there are a couple examples of what a secure mechanism is. However, I did want to note that this is not an exhaustive list, and I know Theo was going to touch on that a little bit later in the presentation, but these are just a couple of examples of what would be considered secure mechanism. So that concludes the basic definitions and process of change of registrant. I do up here have a handout that matches the slides of the process, which pulls the steps out of the policy as a whole. So if that would be helpful to anyone to look over, you're welcome. I can pass them around the room. Lukesh is going to help with that. And for the remote participants, the handout just goes through steps 1 through 9 of the change of registrant, which you can find in section C 1.1 of the policy. And yes, I notice a question from a remote participant. I will email that handout to the registrar list so that everyone can have it. So I'm now going to hand over the floor to Theo if he's willing to share.
Thank you, Caitlin. Yes, I'm willing to share because this is a very, very complex policy where most of us are struggling with the language, I assume. What is a secure mechanism? What is a designated agent? And from what I've been hearing the last couple of days, people are, well, that's sort of my sense of it. People are struggling with the language there. So, what is a secure mechanism? From my perspective, a secure mechanism can be a client's, a registrant's control panel where he can log in. And it can be two-factor authentication, it can be one key factor authentication. These are still considered very secure mechanisms. And from our side, being a reseller, being a registrar with the reseller model, the wholesale model, we just have a mechanism in place where our resellers just confirm that they have explicit consent from the new and the old registrant, and they send us that through an API. So a designated agent is somebody, is an entity, in my opinion, that is like, could be a reseller, could be a web design company, it could be actually anything or everything, as long as you make a definition somewhere along the line. So that's sort of what we are going to do at Real-Time Register. And if we are looking at some of the language there, and you talk with people here with registrars, there's also these questions like, Yeah, but what happens if the email address is no longer correct? Now, there was a particular, we discussed this extensively in the IRT. And at a certain point, and this also came up on the list last night, there is this little sentence that says that registrar is not just limited to. And basically, what it says, like, you can get the information as a registrar through other sources, like your reseller. So at Real-Time Register, we're just gonna introduce a little section in our control panel for resellers. And if the registrant is complaining that the email address is no longer working, he can simply enter the domain name with the new email address. There will be a legal disclaimer there, and that's how we're gonna process a change of the new email address. And then we can continue with the entire change of registrant process there. And that's in a nutshell how we just gonna engage with this policy. I'm just gonna leave it open to the floor here so we can get some discussion going, but it is just what we are going at Real-Time Register. Thanks.
Thank you, Theo. James, I see your hand. I was just going to answer a question in the remote, and then I'll hand it over to James. So I have a question from Reke Pop, and the question is, at the last presentation, you promised to investigate if it was possible to combine the new registrant approval with the verification. And I believe this question is referring to the WHOIS verification as part of the WHOIS accuracy specification. If it's okay to combine the new registrant explicit consent via secure mechanism with the WHOIS verification. And the answer to that question is yes, so long as the secure mechanism meets the requirements of the WHOIS accuracy specification, those two notices can be combined. James, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Caitlin. James Bladel speaking for the record, and thanks, Reike. And just, you know, thinking in, along the same lines, I think that we're very interested as registrars to combine or merge as many messages as possible. I think, you know, at scale, what we find is the more messages you send a registrar, a registrant, a couple things happen. One is they're less likely to take the necessary actions. You start to tune them out. My registrar sends me 100 messages a day. I just don't know what's important anymore. And then the second one is that you know, you could actually trigger some of their junk or bulk mail filters in whatever client they're using. We're taking, I think, you know, internally we've had discussions that secure mechanism is really leaves us a lot of room to innovate, including you know, control panel notifications. As Theo mentioned, two-factor authentication, mobile apps, and other types of communication channels where we might get the registrant's attention a little faster. I wanted to point out, however, one note where you had indicated some of the threshold fields that would trigger a change of registrant. And it's possible that if the email address is not one of those fields changed, if it's just a, you know, for example, someone got married and changed their name, or I changed it from Jim to James, that the new registrant and old registrant consent email or confirmation email would be still the same. And then I'm hoping that that's not a concern. And then to Reiki's point, we're just going to start piling on all of these functions so that if you come to us, and I mean Owen right now, if you come to us later and say, show me that you confirm consent and confirmed the prior registrant consent and verified the WHOIS address, I might be referring you to one email that does all three functions. And so just be advised that I think that a lot of registrars are trying to do that to cut down on the email traffic, because that's where this thing's going to go off the rails. Thanks.
Thank you, James. I do believe that that was a question that Tom Barrett had brought up on Tuesday. And the answer was, there are situations where the prior registrant and new registrant are the exact same entity, exact same individual. And so one communication, so long as it's the same individual, could be sufficient in those situations. So, Seaman, did you have a question, comment?
Yeah, I think you already answered it a bit. Combining emails when the email address is similar for the old and new registrant is obvious, but I think you can also combine an email if the rest of the day, if the company data, the contact data is not changing. If I'm John Doe from company X with old email and I'm John Doe from company X new email, I can, in my opinion, just get the confirmation from the new email address, which confirms both for John Doe 1 and John Doe 2. Is that correct? Do you agree with me?
I think the answer is yes. So it's a little early. I know it's a little early for everyone. So I think if I can restate the question is, if the entity is the same individual, even though their email is changing, could the consent be given, or could the communication still be in one message?
Yes.
And I think depending on the situation, yes. There are situations, for example, where someone may be updating their email address because their email address is no longer correct. And so they wouldn't be able to give consent via a non-working email address.
So this is Mike Zupke, ICANN staff, and I just wanted to add one note to that. And I think, the explanation that Caitlin provided is absolutely correct. But I just, urge everybody to remember that the purpose of this policy, or one of the purposes of this policy, is to prevent domain name hijacking or prevent names from, registrants from losing control of their domain names. And so sort of within the spirit of that, obviously, if you're only confirming with the new registrant's email address, you still run the risk of that happening. And luckily, there is still a notice provision in this. But just something to keep in mind that, the goal of this is really for enhanced security. So to that end, obviously, you as registrars have an interest in that.
Caitlin Darcy Southwell, for the record. To go back just a little bit for some registrars who've been asking questions, can you give just a high-level 2-second overview of why we have this process coming at us, the policy, just high-level? Thank you.
Thank you, Darcy. I may turn the mic over to James, if that's okay. I can say that this came out of the policy development process, IRTPC, and James was part of that working group, so he may be able to provide a little context. But as Mike just mentioned, the goal, or the underlying goal, of the change of registrant recommendation was to, I believe, kind of normalize the way a change of registrant works across all registrars, and particularly with reference to the 60-day lock following a change of registrant. That was, again, to prevent domain name hijacking, so that in the event an account was compromised, the name would still be housed within the same registrar to return the name back to the original registered name holder if there were some sort of account compromise. But James may be able to speak to that more eloquently.
Well, thank you, Caitlin. Just as a little bit of context or background, and I'll try to be brief. The birth of this is actually in 2007, where there was a task force established to find all the problems that were associated with inter-registrar transfers. And unfortunately, there were so many, and that was just such a dense volume of material that it caused ICANN to kick off 5 separate PDPs, IRTPA through IRTPE. And we started working them, and we realized that these things were taking anywhere from 18 to 24 months each. We've started looking for ways to combine them. This particular policy, IRTPC, came out of a recommendation from one of the prior ones, I believe IRTPB, that identified the problems associated with change of registrant. Specifically, that there was this very, very healthy aftermarket setup that was using an inter-registrar transfer policy to affect change of control or change of ownership of domain name assets. And that was failing because the process was not designed to do that. The process was designed to spur competition from network solutions and get people to move their domain names to other registrars in a competitive marketplace. So that was problem number one. Problem number two, hijacking, that people were losing control of domain names that they had that they were using, that they built their businesses or personal identities around, that they were losing control of them without their knowledge or consent. The third one is the reverse of that. People were getting domain names assigned to them without their knowledge or consent. So domain names that had illegal or infringing materials, their identities were being stolen, and that these domain names were being registered on their behalf and used for nefarious purposes. And of course, the registrant is the person or entity that's legally responsible for the use of domain names. So people were becoming cyber squatters without even knowing that they had an account at a registrar. And then the fourth one was that we were encountering a lot of edge cases associated with enforcing UDRPs, court orders, and other registry and legal activities. And so all of this rolled up to, we need to do something to address change of registrant practices, both when you're added as a registrant, when you're removed as a registrant. And a lot of registrars already have some sort of internal process to do that. Some registrars, surprisingly, didn't offer that service. Once you registered a domain name, you could never change it. You had to either delete it or take it to another registrar. And then I think it was there was also a desire from the working group to standardize that, as Caitlin said. So I hope that's just, you know, the high-level summary of how we got here over, what, the last 9 years. Thanks.
Thank you, James. Darcy, does that help? Okay, thank you. There's a couple of questions in the remote participation or from remote participants that I can address now. The first question is from Chris Pelling, and it is, surely if someone has gone to the trouble of compromising an email address, they will simply opt out when logged in beforehand and transfer the domain name. So I believe Chris is referring to opting out of the 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock. And, you know, what would be the point if someone could just opt out? I would like to note that in section, I believe it's C1.2, there is a footnote that says that registrars can make the opt-out or that 60-day lock. They can impose restrictions on that, for example, if they'd like to make it more secure. So that could be something that you, if Chris, if you'd like to make it more secure, if you're afraid of domain name hijacking in that context. The second question comes from Reiki, and the question is, why 60 days? We do see a lot of registrants that want to transfer their domain name after changing ownership. Of course, we would offer the opt-out, but prior registrant might easily miss it. At one.com, we already do get confirmation via control panel email from both prior and new registrant, send confirmation for both, and then we lock the possibility for further changes for 3 days so that the prior registrant has time to react. 60 days seems like a long time. Thank you for that question, Reiki. The answer, why 60 days, is that's what the working group recommended, and so that's what we implemented into policy. Oh, looks like James has some context on that.
I mean, you're not wrong, Caitlin, but I think why 60 days, why not 20 or 10 or 100 or something, is because 60 days was already kind of a number that was used for previous post-transfer, new registration creation, and things like that. So it was a desire to, if there was going to be some kind of a required time frame, that we keep them a standard length so that there weren't all these different lengths or time periods. So I think that's why 60.
Thank you, James. That's helpful. Did anyone have any other questions they can think of in the remote room or in Marrakesh? James?
Is it coming later where you're going to discuss the designated agent?
Yes, I do have a couple of prompting slides about topics that I seem to be getting a lot of questions on to open up the floor about those topics. So if we'd like to move on to designated agent, happy to do so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry. The comment from Reiki is, I am pretty sure 60 days will give me a lot of angry registrants. And a second comment, they will think we do it to annoy them or lock them to us. Simon?
What's wrong with making the opt-out part of your standard process? So at the moment you ask for consent of the prior registrant, also includes the question, do you want to opt out, yes or no? So in fact, enforcing the opt-out up to a certain level.
I'm not sure I understand. Is the question, can you offer the opt-out at the time they request the... So the answer to that question is the prior registrant... Sorry.
It's not directly whether or not you can offer the opt-out at the moment of the getting consent of the prior registrant. That is in the, that's in the policy. That's a fact, we can combine that. But can we try to make opt-out a standard answer and make it an opt-in if the customer wants to do the lock of it? And not by just hiding that information, but for example, just taking the yes box instead of the no box by default.
So the question is, can it be an opt-in by default? So the answer to the question is the registrar has the option of even offering an opt-out. So you don't have to offer an opt-out of the 60 days. I know that was a concern for some registrars who have a lot of aftermarket customers, that when people want to move domain names quickly, they wanted to offer some sort of opt-out. For registrars, again, who do want to offer the opt-out, there is... you can make that more secure, impose restrictions on the opt-out. But in terms of how you want to implement that, that's within the registrar's discretion. So, Mike.
So this is Mike Zepke again from staff. One thing worth noting is that the opt-out has to be offered before the change of registrant request was made. So it sounds like what you were suggesting was it could be after the request is made, you could say, by the way, here's your opt-out, right? And as I read the policy, that would be too late. One thing that is included in the policy, and Caitlin, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but when a person requests to change their registrant, the registrar is required to let that registrant know you will be locked in for 60 days. And if you don't want that, what you should do is transfer to another registrar first and then change your registrant details. So there's at least sort of a conspicuous notice here that says if you don't want to be locked in, here's what you need to do. But at that point, as I understand the policy, it would be too late to say you may still opt out. That would sort of defeat the purpose of the lock.
Thank you, Mike. We have a couple hands. I think James is first and then Elliot. James.
Jeff, and then I think Volker had his hands up.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
So just quickly, I agree with you, Mike, that this policy, this section of IRTPC, says that you must obtain that opt-out prior to effecting that change of registrant. So it'd be situational. For example, just a standard change of registrant, you might not do it. But if you had a process of listing a domain name for sale, you might collect the opt-out at that time. So that's one example. However, I would also point out, Mike, that there are other policies that constrain or even provide, it would seem, to obligate registrars to remove any locks, potentially including this one, if the registrant demonstrates that they are who they say they are and request it within a five-day period. And that's other sections of the transfer policy. So I agree with your interpretation of this policy. It's just how we stitch it together with the other requirements that that it might be possible to remove a lock during that 60-day period if a registrant really raises a ruckus and, you know, shows up at your door with their passport and birth certificate and their, you know, and their mother and a blood sample, then maybe you would remove the lock and you would be justified in doing so under other aspects of the policy, which require you not to put too many impediments in place to prevent transfer out. So that's just another thought on that.
Jeff.
Thanks, James. I think you should probably remove the registrants if they come with a blood sample to your office.
I think you call security.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I'm not sure if it's explicitly clear on, the opt-out, can that be done via secure mechanism at an account level prior, you know, when starting the account, or does it have to be done on a domain-by-domain basis? Because if we have, you know, customers who – transmit to us via some secure mechanism, they'd want to opt out, call it on a global basis or for their account, for all their domains, and they've understood, you know, say there's some sort of, you know, they have to click some of the terms and conditions or whatever that is. Is that allowed, or is that has to be, or can this has to be done the opt-out on each specific transfer?
Thank you, Jeff. I think the answer to that question is it can be done on a global level as long as the registrar can show that that particular prior registrant opted out of the 60-day lock. Testing the remote participants hear me? Back? Okay. So I'm just going to repeat the question just in case Reiki didn't hear, but the question was, would it be possible to ask the prior registrant for the option to remove the lock later? And I'm assuming that later means once the 60-day lock is in place, can the prior registrant ask for the lock to be removed? And the answer in the context of this policy is no. The prior registrant needs to opt out of that lock before the change of registrant request. And that's for that domain name hijacking that we had discussed earlier this morning. Okay, did anyone have any other questions about the 60-day lock before we move on to discussing designated agents? Okay. Can you move the slide, please? Thank you. Okay. So I've received a lot of questions about what is a designated agent. And on this slide, you'll see the definition, which is the definition of the policy. And the designated agent means an individual or entity that the prior registrant or new registrant explicitly authorizes to approve a change of registrant on its behalf. And I was going to open the floor to maybe some of the members of the implementation review team to talk a little bit about that definition that we arrived on. There's a couple of questions from remote participants. The question is, but we could then state that if you provide passport question, you can then opt out and be allowed within 5 days. I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry.
So this is Mike Zupke, and we were just trying to interpret the question in the room. Sorry, we're off microphone there. So I think, and you know, Kaylin, I don't, you can correct me here, but the lock, the rules around the lock are pretty specific. The rules around the opt-out are much less specific. So it sounds like what's being suggested is almost an alternative lock. And so maybe in that case, you know, you offer the opt-out, but with some conditions on the opt-out. So you say you can opt out of the 60-day lock. However, we're still going to impose a 5-day waiting period during which time we'll ask you for additional authentication or something like that. That might be the solution, sort of phrased a different way than it was asked.
Okay, thank you. So again, back to the discussion of designated agents. This was something that was requested by both in the working group's final report. There are, of course, situations where someone may want to have someone else be able to approve any sort of change without having it go directly to the registered name holder. And so this allows registrars to have some flexibility in terms of who can approve these types of requests. Did anyone have any specific questions on designated agent?
This is Darcy. So I think it's interesting that it's missing from the final step in the notification, which I think is sort of, you know, we follow this process that includes either the prior registrant or the designated agent, and all of a sudden that piece is missing. And I mean, I can definitely see glitches there where we've been communicating with one and all of a sudden we're notifying this and they don't know. Similar to what James said earlier, I mean, one more email to somebody who isn't sure what to do with it and what are the ramifications, especially for allowing them to cancel with that notification.
Thank you, Darcy. And Darcy did bring up a good point, which is you'll notice that in the notification step, it is the prior registrant and the new registrant that are notified of the change, not the designated agent. Of course, the designated agent can also be notified. However, the registrar is required to notify the prior registrant and new registrant. And that was another security so that the actual prior registrant is noted that there's been this change to their account. Does anyone else have any?
So I'm going to reiterate what Bob said in the chat, Bob Mountain said in the chat, Darcy. But, you know, we kind of hoped, I think, that was an oversight. So telling us this, that was not an oversight. Okay. Thank you.
No, that was purposeful. Okay. Any more questions about designated agents? Okay. Another common question that I get. Non-working addresses. Question is, what if the prior registrant is trying to update a non-working address, and how are they supposed to give consent? And we may have already covered this, but I did just want to bring this up again. You'll notice that there is a footnote in the policy that allows registrars to use additional contact information on file when obtaining confirmation from the prior registrant. And I believe Theo touched on this earlier. Theo, would you mind talking again about how you were planning on implementing this?
Yes, just Theo for the record. Yeah, we sort of saw a little problem coming up there with our registrar. And as a registrar working with sellers, we do not have a lot of information to go on. I mean, we got the WHOIS data, and that's it. And if the email address is incorrect, we foresaw a problem there that we would be going through some kind of nasty verification process with maybe SMS or even mail and using special codes. And then we basically went back to the question, and this was discussed extensively in the IRT, and basically I thought, okay, with the information we discussed in the IRT, we basically came back to the point that as for us, who actually has the data for our registrants, and that is our resellers. They usually have more information on file than we have. They have secondary email addresses, or they can simply reach out to their customers. And so basically, we're going to just offer our resellers this section on our website where our resellers can log in and they just update the domain name with a new email address that is working. And of course, they got to confirm that they went to some kind of secure process to make sure that we are still in spirit there of the entire policy. So that's what we are going to do there.
Thank you, Theo. Rob, did you have a question or were you just stretching? Okay, just stretching. Question? Okay, thank you. Another question from Reiki. And the question is, would a written and signed request be, quote, using additional information? And I think the answer to that question is it could be yes. If you have some, if you request a signed statement from the prior registrant authorizing this change. Sarah, did you have a question?
Yeah, I think so. This is Sarah Bakke, for the record. I was going to bring up just a further question regarding the designated agent for Bob Mountain, because I think there's some confusion as to how that is going to work with the aftermarket, because having to contact the prior and new registrant in that final step and not being able to use the designated agent will be problematic for that platform. So how should they make that work, I guess is the question. Or was that considered when that final step was made?
So if I remember correctly, the reason that the consent can be obtained via the designated agent, provided that the prior and or new registrant have both explicitly consented and authorized their designated agent to approve these requests on their behalf. However, in terms of the notification, that was just a security step that the actual registered name holder is notified that there's been a change, kind of like the FOA needs to be sent to the transfer contact.
So even after they have the designated agent, then they have to go back and confirm with the. No, I'm not getting that
No,
right.
sorry. That's a good question, Sarah. So, once the registrar has obtained the explicit consent from both the prior and new registrant, they have some flexibility in terms of when they send that notification. If the notification is sent after the change has been applied, the registrar does not need to ask the registrant. So the prior registrant to approve it. It's already been approved at that point. It's just the notification needs to go to that registrant saying this change has been made so that they're getting an email saying that it's been applied.
This is Darcy, but if I'm not mistaken, that requirement C 1.1.7 says that there has to be an option, instructions on how to cancel. It's not just notification of a change, it's instructions on how to cancel, which I think is one of my concerns with the secondary market, that you're going to be opening up the opportunity for the prior registrant who wasn't involved before because the designated agent has been handling this. Now they have instructions on how to cancel a change that was made and was made properly, according to a variety of things that have happened as far as transactions. So that's, I think that's the concern.
Thank you, Darcy. Yes, James.
Yeah, I thought I understood this, but now Darcy's statement is making me ask questions. Are we saying that they can, in the moment of the transfer, undesignate the agent? Is that what we're saying? Because I'm saying like a designated agent is a designated agent, and if you are requiring us, then there is no designated agent. If you're requiring us to give the person who gave their designation to the agent the ability to cancel the transfer, then now we have two responsible parties, the designated agent and the prior registrant. I think that designation has to be total or none. I think we've got some ambiguity here that's causing a little bit of confusion around the room. I wasn't following. Thank you, Darcy, for kind of teeing it up there because there's some stuff going on in the chat and I'm arguing the wrong thing apparently because I didn't get that the prior registrant could overrule the designated agent, in the moment, which I think that's not how, at least that's not how I envisioned the designated agent working. Thanks. It just seems like a little bit of a gray area. It needs to be tightened up.
Thank you, James and Darcy. Okay, the comment from Bob Mountain is, agree, James. I think the intent of the working group was that the designated agent would propagate and just wasn't specifically referenced in molecular detail in every section.
So I think from our, this is Darcy, from our perspective, we have no objection in a situation like secondary market where you have a designated agent or any other reason you have a designated agent sending a notification to a prior registrant so that they know the change took place. It's the cancellation that's the challenge for us. Because to James's point, and I love how he said it, you're kind of undoing the fact that there was a designated agent relationship at all. And in some cases, we as the registrar are not even involved in that designated agent relationship. So it's something, you know, let's say in the aftermarket that that provider and the prior registrant had, and we're completely unaware of it. So it's going to cause a lot of hiccups, I think. James?
Actually, Volker, did you have your hand up? And sorry, I'm just.
Yeah, just one question. Just one question for clarification. I mean, it has been my understanding that under 1.1.6, the notification can also be sent before the completion of the change of registrant request, i.e., they can be combined with a request or with a secure mechanism in itself. So instead of having to send out 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 messages, you could have 2 messages, or if it's the same person at the same email address, even 1 message that that fulfills all those requirements.
James?
So one final thought on why we can't allow this. I just had the thought. I mean, Darcy brings up the aftermarket situation. There's the privacy proxy service provider issue where we wrestled with how to implement that. Not fully addressed in the privacy proxy spec because we figured we had it handled with a designated agent. So I think, and then the third one is there could be, and I'm not saying that I know of any, but there could be security products or anti-hijacking products that we've just created a loophole for hijackers. Because if they've designated a security firm, for example, like, you know, some kind of a vault service to manage their domain names, but someone cracks their account, now that someone has compromised the designated agent account. And so I believe there's a third scenario. There's the privacy proxy, there's the aftermarket, and now there's this, we've actually created a hijacking risk, probably inadvertently, but I think we need to think carefully about how we can, you know, button this down. Thanks.
Thank you, James and Darcy. This is helpful. Did anyone have any other questions or comments? Yes.
Hi, Rich with GoDaddy. Rich Murdy with GoDaddy. And a question is that last, the issue, the ability to, and instructions on cancellation, or is the issue also with notification in general, as far as the communication with the registrant? I just wanted to see if thinning it down to just notification, as it was described in the beginning, would address the issue.
I think it's cancellation is the problem. I mean, notification, we were saying earlier, we don't want to keep machine gunning emails at these poor souls. So we probably would like to be able to not notify. But I think it's cancellation is creates the back door.
And Darcy is nodding her head.
I mean, ideally, yes, Darcy. No notification would be fantastic. They already get enough emails. We could definitely live with if it was just the cancellation. I think the notification is still going to drive call volume to customer service that they can't help, which is frustrating for a registrar, but notification is probably okay.
Any other questions or concerns about designated agents? Okay. Question from a remote participant. If an issue with the policy has been identified, what happens next? Will the policy be delayed? Thank you for that question. I think it always depends on the issue that's been identified. If it's a minor change, if it's a big change, generally we can't unilaterally just change the policy, but we'll certainly take it back and discuss that and notify the registrars of the next steps. Yes, Jeff.
So I guess one of the points on the timing is when you're saying we can't unilaterally, you're saying I can, staff can't unilaterally, but you have a request from the registrar stakeholder group and that, and then ICANN staff also agrees that then it wouldn't be a unilateral change. It would be an agreed upon. So would you want something formally from us if we conferred and said, hey, we think we need to pay for X amount of time to work out? These issues with that
just a few minutes ago, the designated agent can work if the privacy proxy service is a separate entity. If it's not, then I don't know what to do.
Thank you, James Volker. Did that at a hand?
Yeah, and to just expand on what James said, for us as a registrar, when the privacy proxy service is affiliated with us, then we know what the underlying data is. And if it's turned off to the underlying data, then we would probably not consider it a material change. However, if the privacy proxy service is not affiliated with us and we do not know who the underlying registrant is, removing the privacy proxy data and replacing it with the potential or maybe not actual registrant data would be a material change. At least that was our interpretation.
So this is Mike Zepke from staff, and it sounds like both scenarios you identified would be material changes in accordance with the policy. If the registrant, being a proxy service, is removed in who is and another person's name is placed, you've had a change of registrant. And in the case of a privacy service, if the contact information is changed, then you've also had a change of registrant according to the definition that the working group gave us. While we understand that that seems potentially illogical in the result, we think that that's where the notion of designated agents probably helps relieve some of the issue. So you don't necessarily have to get the underlying customer's approval if you are disabling the proxy service in accordance with your terms and conditions, for example.
Seaman?
Thank you. Seaman for the records. When looking into the specification on privacy proxy services, point 1.2, it defines that the privacy service is a service by which a registered name is registered to its beneficial user as the registered name holder, but for which an alternative contact information is displayed in whois. Summary. As the changes to the transfer process are targeted on the registered name holder, I would say turning on and off the privacy service does not at all change the registered name holder as the holder of the domain name. So in my opinion, in my understanding, it should be able to do so without any confirmation of the domain holder, which does not change at all.
Thank you, Seaman. I'm just going to reiterate what Mike just said, which is within the definitions that we have in the policy, a removal of a privacy or proxy service would be a material change.
And this is Mike. So, what we're referring to is section, sorry, I forgot to scroll up. So it's two Roman numeral 2A113, which is defining material change. And this explains what is a material change to the registered name holder. So 1131 says a change to the registered name holder's name or organization that it does not appear to be merely typographical correction. 1132 says any change to the registered name holder's name or organization which is accompanied by a change of address or phone number. And 1133 is a change to the registered name holder's email address. So if the privacy service that you're describing involves a change to the email address, then this would be triggered. However, if the email address is actually the customer's and the name is the customer's and all it's changing is the mailing address and phone number, then perhaps you're not affected.
A couple questions from remote participants. The question again is from Reiki, and I believe the question is, did I understand Mike correctly that we can build the approval into our terms for privacy proxy? And I believe the approval is referring to the privacy or proxy being a designated agent, if I'm understanding that correctly. And the answer is, yes, you could. The privacy or proxy service could be the designated agent. And the approval to explicitly or authorize the privacy or proxy to confirm changes or authorize changes on its behalf could be done in the terms for the privacy or proxy service. A couple more questions. I did want to note we have 1 more minute, so any questions that aren't addressed now, I can follow up via email. So the question is, the registered name holder is the person as deposited by the RDE, correct or not? So, and the question is from Chris Pelling. So the definition that is important here is the definition for prior registrant, I believe, is what Chris is referring to. And that is the registered name holder at the time the change is requested. So that would be what would be showing in the who is at the time the change of registrant is requested. And with that, I'd like to thank everyone for attending the session. I think it was a good discussion, and thanks to the members of the implementation review team that helped provide some background information. That was very helpful. If anyone still has questions that weren't answered, please feel free to send them to raaquestions@icann.org, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Thank you.